Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIS podcast series. This is the 11th podcast we're doing on the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war on global gas markets. My name's James Henderson. I'm chairman of the gas program. And with me, as usual, I've got Mike Fullwood and Jack Sharples. We've been away for a couple of weeks, mainly because Jack's been on holiday in Scotland, or as we Hendersons like to know it, God's own country. But he's back now, and he's ready with his stats and his discussion of European storage, amongst other things. And indeed, he and Mike and our colleague Anouk Honoré put out a paper called REPowerEU and the Short-Term Outlook for the European Gas Market on the 7th of July. And so we're going to discuss the details of that as well. So Mike and Jack, you're very welcome back to the podcast. And Jack, I'm going to come to you first, and let's get our regular update on Russian flows into Europe. What's been going on in the last couple of weeks in your absence?
The routes that were closed down and fell to zero have remained very much so. So that's zero flows to Finland and the Baltics, except a very tiny amount to Latvia. Also still zero into Northwest Europe along the Yamal Europe pipeline and down into Southeastern Europe along the Trans-Balkan pipeline from Ukraine into Romania. And also still zero flows into Poland at Wysokoye and Drozdowice via Belarus and Ukraine respectively. So we are in effect left with several large routes, if you like, for the delivery of Russian gas to Europe now. Nord Stream 1, Ukrainian transit to Slovakia and a very small amount to Hungary, and lastly, Turkish Stream, which has obviously just come back from its maintenance period. So in terms of Nord Stream 1, from the middle of June through to yesterday, the pipeline was operating at just over a third of its capacity, so flowing about 66 million cubic meters per day out of its 165 million cubic meter capacity. But obviously, we now enter a 10-day maintenance period, and all eyes will be on whether or not those flows resume on the 21st of July. At the Western Ukrainian border with Slovakia, flows are very stable at around 35 million cubic meters per day. So pretty much the same level they've been at since the beginning of June. Finally, we have a very small amount flowing from Ukraine into Hungary at the Bereg virtual interconnection point. And then obviously the continuation of flows via the Turkish Stream pipeline. Obviously, Bulgaria has been cut off on that route, but that gas is continuing to flow via Bulgaria up to Serbia and Hungary, and in a slightly different direction, also via Bulgaria, to North Macedonia and Greece.
So the big news there, I think, has been the reduction in flows on Nord Stream 1, which, as many of our listeners may know, was caused by a reduction in compression. Mike, let me come to you about that. I mean, clearly the issue was the Siemens compressor going to Canada and then not coming back again. Can you give us an update on that and what we think might happen post this maintenance period?
Yeah, thank you, Jim. Yeah, it seems that the compressor's holiday in Canada, just like Jack's, is now over, and it's been reported that the Canadian government has now given it permission to at least return to Germany. Then it's the Germans' problem as to what they do with it, which seems to imply that actually it will be sent back to Russia for the Portovoye compressor station. So that, in a sense, is good news in terms of possibly higher flows or the intention that Nord Stream will resume after its maintenance period. It's not clear when it will be sent back and when it'll be installed. And obviously Gazprom has said there's potential maintenance needed on other compressors. So it is unclear, even if that one comes back on, how much the flow will increase. You might imagine it would increase from its current, as Jack was talking about 40% of capacity, but the timing is uncertain.
Okay, so some hope then we get an increase in Nord Stream 1 flows post the maintenance period, but we'll keep an eye on. So 10 days from, we're currently recording this on the 11th of July, and I think the maintenance period actually started today, didn't it? So we're talking about the 21st of July when that period should come to an end. So we'll be keeping a close eye out then. Jack, let me come to you on other pipeline flows, if I may. Can you talk to us a little bit about North Africa and also the flows from Azerbaijan? What's going on there?
Well, from Azerbaijan, the picture is pretty clear, with those flows being measured on the Turkey-Greece border along the Trans-Adriatic pipeline. We're still operating at full capacity, so we're talking maybe 32 to 34 million cubic metres per day. Algeria, it's a bit of a different question, really. So while the Azeri flows seem to be constrained by pipeline capacity, that is very much not the case with the flows from North Africa. Indeed, the total flows from Algeria and Libya for the first half of this year are down by about 3.5 BCM year on year. That's about a 17% drop. The flows are currently at around 90 million cubic meters per day, bouncing around there. They're pretty stable, but it's not using all of the pipeline capacity that they have, particularly the pipeline capacity they have to Italy. So even though we've lost one of the two pipelines connecting Algeria with Spain, that being the transit pipeline via Morocco, it seems as though the issue here is really the Azeris having enough gas to export rather than any pipeline constraints.
Okay, so not much potential upside there then, as I think we've discussed in previous research. Mike, let me come back to you on European production. There's been some discussion in the last couple of weeks about the Groningen field in the Netherlands and whether, you know, we've seen the Dutch government sanction the production of 2.8 BCM this year, I think. But there's potential for further upside in emergency situations. What do you think the situation there is now?
I mean, they've said, I mean, originally it was thought that it might actually close down in 2022. I think the Dutch government have given sort of permission or authorization for production of about 2.8 BCM, which is pretty close to zero. And then after that, it will probably close. There's some reports in the press as to about whether, in the event of a real dire emergency, let's say if Russia pipe flows to Europe, the EU completely cut off, as to whether you could you increase Groningen production. I think technically, obviously, you probably could, unless wells have been sort of completely shut down. But I think it would be more a political decision as to whether the Dutch government would, in an extreme emergency, allow production to increase, especially if there's danger of the lights going off in Germany and sort of central European countries, which are most impacted by the any full curtailment of Russia pipeline flows.
Because the potential for the Groningen field to produce significantly more is still there, is it not? I mean, obviously, there's the earthquake risk that they'd have to deal with. But in terms of the gas in the ground, there's still plenty left.
Oh, there's a huge amount of gas left. I mean, if you temporarily forget the poor people in Groningen with the houses cracking, then I'm sure you can still produce quite a lot. I guess I think it does come down to political decision. As to whether there would be a sort of even a ground sort of opinion in the Netherlands that, well, maybe in extreme circumstances, well, yes, let's produce more to help out our EU friends, basically.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens there as we head towards winter. Jack, let me come back to you. So we put all this supply together and historically you've done that and come up with a proxy for European demand. So what are you seeing on the demand side then? Are high prices having an impact?
Well, they are. I think another element of this that we haven't yet touched upon, but I should add in at this juncture, is the flow from Norway. So we're still getting around 340 million cubic metres per day in the first 10 days of July, which is the equivalent of around 124 BCMA. So it's a substantial volume that we're getting from Norway. Those pipelines from Norway to the EU are at full capacity. The only pipeline out of Norway that's not at full capacity at the moment is the Langeled pipeline to the UK, which is operating at about 55 million cubic metres a day out of its capacity of 75 million cubic metres per day. So, you know, as with, as you know, where Azerbaijan is pumping at full capacity and is constrained by its pipelines, Algeria doesn't have much more to give, seemingly, on the production side. Norway is going hell for leather and has fortunately avoided some of the strike issues that we've seen reported in the press recently. So in terms of how this all fits together, total supply to the European market is down about 12% year on year in the first half of this year compared to last year. So that's a decline from about 268 BCM to about 236 BCM. In terms of full month figures for our most recent full month, so that's June. This year, you're looking at an average of about 760 million cubic meters per day, which is markedly down on last year, around 846 million cubic meters per day. And interestingly, significantly down even compared to June 2020, when we were in the midst of the COVID pandemic, when about 900 million cubic meters per day were making their way into the European market. So clearly there is very much a demand side reduction here going on.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you note in your paper that, of course, the REPowerEU kind of target was for a reduction on the demand side of 38 BCM. And it looks like, well, clearly we're well over halfway there. So that's pretty encouraging. I mean, it's mainly, I guess, price and weather related at the moment.
Yes, it would seem to be so. You know, obviously the LNG flows into Europe are up dramatically year on year, somewhat offsetting the loss in Russian flows. All of the non-Russian pipeline suppliers are going at full tilt, being constrained either by their own production capacity or their export pipelines. And then obviously, in terms of European production, we've seen UK production bounce back from its maintenance last summer that was affected by COVID, you know, maintenance being postponed by a year, and elsewhere, the general decline in European production continues. So things are tight on the supply side, but they're not catastrophically tight. And it does seem to be that we are seeing a price-driven reduction in European demand.
Great. Now, well, you've prompted me there because, of course, the elephant in the room we haven't talked about yet is LNG. So, Mike, I'm going to come back to you on that. We have talked a lot about LNG being available to Europe and Europe taking a lot more of it. Is that continuing? Obviously, there's been some supply side issues over in the US. What's happening there? Give us an update.
Yeah, I mean, up till we've now got the June numbers for LNG, it's the first 6 months of the year. That now the problem with Freeport, the fire there, didn't really impact the June numbers that much, as obviously a lot of the LNG had already been sent out. I think it will obviously impact the July figures, but that's got a significant volume to be sort of taken off the market. You know, it could be 9-10 BCM for the rest of the year. So that has obviously got a constrained supply a little bit. However, up until the 6 months of the year, we've seen about a 13.5 BCM increase in, you know, LNG trade. And obviously on the demand side, I mean, the sort of astonishing story is that almost 29 BCM increase in LNG imports into Europe has happened. So it's more than double the amount of supply has increased. We've seen a little bit of increase in demand in the Asian countries, especially Thailand, who have been struggling with imports from Myanmar, also Indonesia and Malaysia. And then on the downside, it's the rest of the Asian markets. Obviously, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, in Pakistan in particular, have been down because of the price effects on their very price-sensitive markets. Japan, Korea, Taiwan also down. But the astonishing number is that LNG imports into China are down 11 BCM in the first 6 months of the year. That's unheard of in the history of Chinese LNG. And if somebody had said at the end of last year that Chinese LNG imports would be 11 BCM down, they'd have thought you'd gone mad. And obviously it's the lockdowns, the weak economic activity, and even to be flat to be at last year's levels for the rest of the year requires a significant increase in LNG imports into China for the rest of the year. So in a sense, Europe has been, I say, use the word lucky advisedly. You know, supply has kept up well, and China's not need the LNG, so a lot could come to Europe. On the actual export side, obviously, you know, North America, the US is effectively providing most of the increase in supply. There's also been increase in for Australia and Papua New Guinea as well. Papua New Guinea, because of the extended maintenance downtime last year, and also Prelude sort of started to come back on. Then now there's a strike there, so that may reduce the flows. That's been the real increase. But also Russia is up slightly year on year. So Yamal and Sakhalin are still pumping out the LNG exports, notwithstanding any potential sanctions, although sanctions don't appear to have hit the LNG market at all yet. The downsides on the supply side is North Africa. Algeria volumes are down over 2 BCM year on year. So what Jack was saying about pipeline flows to Algeria, this does seem to imply they are supply constrained in terms of the amount of gas they can flow out of Algeria at the moment.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. So, I mean, more supply and, as you say, Europe being pretty fortunate about demand being weak in Asia, particularly in China. Jack, I'm going to come back to you now because it's time for that perennial question about storage. I mean, you, if I remember correctly, before you went off on your holiday, you were getting slightly less optimistic. In fact, I'd almost go as far as to say you were getting slightly pessimistic, which was concerning many of us. I hope you've come back refreshed and a bit more perky. Are you now feeling a little more bullish about storage? How is the graph looking? How is the outlook for October the 1st for storage at the moment?
Well, the headline figure is looking, I don't know about encouraging, but certainly, let's say, solid, middle of the road. So on the 9th of July, the most recent figure that we have, Europe had about 64 BCM in storage. So that's about 62% full. Now, to put that into context, on the 9th of July in the summer of 2018 and the summer of 2021, when we were recovering from a very cold winter in which we drew down storage very heavily, we had about 54 BCM in storage on that date. So we're about 10 BCM better off than we were after a cold winter. We are significantly down compared to where we were on this date in 2019 and 2020, when Europe had 79 and 87 BCM in storage on those dates respectively. But those were exceptionally supply long years and storage was really absorbing that excess. So if anything, the present storage stocks are very much middle of the road, let's say. But of course, what we're looking at for the rest of the summer, when we aim to inject another 16 BCM between now and the 1st of November, under ordinary circumstances, that would seem to be eminently doable. But of course, there is a huge uncertainty about Russian flows for the rest of this summer, whether the flows from Nord Stream will indeed resume after the maintenance. So there is a significant dose of uncertainty, let's say. So I'm certainly no longer optimistic or confident, but I haven't quite tipped over into absolute despair, let's say, sort of cautiously concerned, let's say.
Okay, so the holiday has had some benefit then, not completely despairing. I mean, if I look at the graph, which I'm doing at the moment, from your report, I mean, the current trajectory would suggest, as you've said, that we could actually get to something like 90 BCM even by the 1st of October. But of course, as you point out, that's completely dependent on Russian flows returning from Nord Stream.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if we were to follow last year's trajectory, so between the 9th of July and the beginning of winter, we injected about 27 BCM into storage, which would suggest that if we were able to, replicate that this summer, we would certainly meet our target and could even get beyond 80 BCM up to 90 BCM by the start of winter. But of course, that is absolutely predicated on, demand continuing to be suppressed by prices, LNG continuing to flow, as Mike was saying, thanks to China sort of not taking as much off the market as it might otherwise have done, and a series of other somewhat benign circumstances, let's say, including getting Nord Stream 1 back flowing after its maintenance period. So plenty of uncertainty.
Okay, well, let's talk about those kind of uncertainties and the outlook for winter 22 and actually on into 23. Might be, let me come back to you. What's, first of all, let's talk about LNG outlook. I mean, how are things looking now for new developments on the supply side? What are your thoughts about whether the China situation is going to get repeated into 2023? How do you put the supply-demand balance together? And can you see a world in which we kind of get through this winter without any problems?
Yeah, let's go to the winter first. I think from the LNG perspective, I mean, obviously, yeah, if we're losing maybe 9, 10 BCM from Freeport, that's a big hit to the market. However, I mean, Norway is now back on, and it actually seemed to send out some volumes in June. So that seems to be some motoring ahead. We got Calcasieu Pass, the Venture Global project, which is getting more trains to switch on, approved by FERC. So I imagine in the next month that may be up to actually sort of full capacity, which is going to help. And then we compared to last year, we've still got the unwinding of some of the issues we had in July, August, September. From various plants. So on the supply side, we're looking at an increase sort of year on year to to happen in the second half of the year. So then turn to the demand side. There doesn't appear at the moment to be any sort of real uptick in Asian demand from Japan, Korea, Taiwan. As we said, even if China returns to last year's levels, which requires an increase from current levels, then we're still looking at Europe maybe being able to import well over 40 BCM more in 2022 than in 2021. A lot of that will be in the next July, August, September period, as the final quarter last year, imports were already at quite a sort of buoyant level. But 40 BCM plus is not impossible, shall we say, which actually is quite close to the EU's sort of 50 BCM increase. But it does rely on continued, in effect, imports of LNG into the UK, which a lot of commentators seem to forget about. I've seen a lot of discussion recently, and they seem to forget about the UK importing LNG, then re-exporting down the interconnector to Europe to help Europe out. So on the LNG side, I think we're looking at reasonably positive, unless there's another supply interruption or unless there's a sudden resurgence in sort of Asian LNG demand. So it's looking pretty good from that perspective.
When you look at the supply side then, I mean, we've talked a little bit about demand being down. There is a scenario then, even in a Russian cutoff, that we can actually get through the winter, or is that going too far?
I think a cutoff will be going too far. But let's say in the paper you just quoted, which is available on our website, we talked about Russia flows after the Nord Stream maintenance returning to what they were before the maintenance at about 40% capacity utilization for Nord Stream, some through Ukraine, some through Turk Stream. If they maintained at that level, if LNG supply, there's no more shocks to that, if China demand doesn't pick up that much, if we have a mild winter, big, big question on the mild winter, then looking at the winter as a whole, we might just about be able to, as we said, muddle through without any significant ration of demand. However, that does almost assume perfect foresight that we're going to get a mild winter, and you would actually have to draw down storage quite significantly, probably starting, you know, certainly December, January, and February, to levels that you might be concerned about if you then expected a cold spell in March and April. So you're pretty much emptying storage quite rapidly with very low Russian flows. Now, if you wanted to be more cautious and keep more gas in storage, then even with Russia flows continuing at the sort of pre-Nord Stream maintenance levels, you might have to ration demand significantly. But that will be to protect storage. Clearly, a cold winter and all bets are off. That would empty storage very, very rapidly with the low levels of Russian flows. So it is just about muddling through if you're kind of prepared to take the risk in a mild winter that you don't need much gas in storage when you're entering March.
Okay, let's go to that storage issue. And Jack, let me come back to you on that as our storage guy. So are there any issues with withdrawal capacity from storage? I mean, clearly you've got to get the gas out and to the market. So that's one question. And how do you see the kind of storage strategy for winter 2022 in Europe?
Well, in terms of the daily withdrawal capacity, we never get anywhere near that. So in that sense, it's no real hindrance, let's say. If you got up too close to your daily withdrawal capacity, then you would draw down your stocks very, very rapidly. And that doesn't really happen. You would need to get up to that level of daily withdrawals and sustain it for several months, and then you would pretty much empty your storage in that time period. The only times that we've seen storage being emptied very quickly is when you have a particular cold spell. So, for example, the Beast from the East, at the end of February, early March of 2018, we were seeing European stocks falling at a rate of about 1 BCM a day for sort of about 10 days in a row. So you can see how you might easily draw down almost the entirety of your storage capacity if you did, you know, if you made withdrawals like that for sort of several months. If you started the winter with about 80 BCM in storage and then 2 or 3 months of very rapid drawdowns, you could quite easily empty it. It's quite interesting to note, actually, that in the spring of 2018, just after that Beast from the East, we hit sort of the lowest level of end of winter storage for recent years at about 18 BCM. Now, for comparison, the winter that we just left through into April 2022, we finished that with about 27 BCM in storage. And in the intervening years, we've generally ended with a bit more than that. So as Mike was saying, there does seem to be a bit of a strategy of keeping gas in storage ready for the late winter period, just in case you have a particularly cold spell. Indeed, we saw that in April of last year, having had the very cold spell across Northeast Asia in January, the snowstorms in the Gulf of Mexico in the US. We then had what was not really a dramatically cold spell in Europe, but a sustained chilly spell, if you like, in which we ended up not making any net injections in April because we kept taking a bit out, putting a bit in, taking a bit out. So there's always that risk that you have a late winter cold snap. So I think that what people really need to be aware of is it might look okay if we meet our storage target for the 1st of October or the 1st of November, but if we withdraw it down very rapidly, as Mike said, we could get ourselves caught out at the end of winter. And even if we don't, even if we manage that storage throughout the winter period but do draw out most of it, it does mean that next summer we are going to have to battle just as hard to refill that storage. And I would say perhaps we'd have to battle even harder than we have done in the summer so far, because obviously it's only in the last couple of months that we've seen any significant reduction in Russian pipeline supply. Whereas this time next year, we'll have been battling through that pretty much from the end of the first quarter.
Okay, so potential concerns about the end of winter 22-23, a sort of slightly fingers crossed attitude to strategy if we draw down storage too early. But that brings us to questions about the outlook for 23. Mike, let me come back to you. I mean, do you see the trends from 22 continuing into 23? I mean, what's the outlook for Chinese gas demand, which seems to be a critical driver? What's the outlook for LNG supply? Are we going to see 22 replayed all over again, or is there a different trajectory for next year?
Yeah, as they say, it's it could be deja vu all over again. But yeah, I think that's the problem is we, as Jack was saying, we're probably entering in a worse position at the end of this winter, even if you manage to muddle through than we started, at the end of last winter. So, I think on the LNG supply front, I think it's reasonably good news. I mean, you'd imagine Freeport would be back up and running by the beginning of next year. So that's quite a lot to supply. Got Coral FLNG, which apparently is now putting gas into the floating LNG liquefaction facility. So that could be on towards the end of this year. The Tortue project now seems to be pushed back towards the end of next year, but the Tangguh train through Indonesia may come on. We have a full year out of Calcasieu Pass and the Sabine Pass. And hopefully, obviously, a full year out of Norway as well. So the supply situation actually looks quite bullish for LNG. A bit of a turnaround with some projects that are coming back, existing ones coming back on. Then you turn to the demand side. If Europe does achieve a 40 BCM increase this year, you can't really repeat that next year, even with buoyant supply, unless demand in Asia again is flat or down. And it seems difficult to imagine that China will still be in lockdown 12 months from now, and economic activity will be very low. So you might expect quite a buoyant jump in demand from China, eating up a lot of the increase in supply, which then constrains what Europe can get coming next year. Because if Russia flows stay, you know, sort of the pre-maintenance levels, that's going to be a big fall from this year in Russian flows next year. So the market is ever tightening ever more. So Europe could get an increased LNG imports next year over this year, which is already at sort of record highs, but it will require to get to the markets affected, new regas capacity in Northwest Europe. We think of the Netherlands and Germany in particular.
Okay, thanks, Mike, for that. So, I mean, we'll obviously come back to the outlook for 23 later in the year, I'm sure, in another podcast. I think for the time being, our time is pretty much up now, but it strikes me that the next one will have to be a reflection on the maintenance on Nord Stream 1, which will be back hopefully in 10 days. And so I'm sure we'll be back then as well. But for the meantime, Mike, Jack, thank you very much for your input today. Please do look out for their report on our website. Just as a reminder, it's called Repower EU and the Short-Term Outlook for European Gas Market, and it's written with our colleague Anouk Honoré. With that, thank you very much indeed for listening. Please do stay healthy, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.